KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.
In the studio, we've got with us Patricia Patterson, Dolly Phelps, and Chase Griffith, all professionals in the cannabis industry here on the Kenai Peninsula. And thank you so much all for being here. And so much to talk about because I know coming up next week, there's the big Marijuana Control Board meeting, which is a pretty big deal for folks who are in the industry, that happening in Kenai. And we're going to have plenty of chance to talk about that and what you guys are hoping to see accomplished at that meeting, what you're taking there. But first, I just kind of want to go down the line. And as we sit here, you know, 2 years into this adventure of commercialized cannabis sales in the state of Alaska, what are your thoughts? What's going well? What's happening? What's new in the world? Let's start with you, Chase.
Great. Yeah. So what's going well is that it's legal in the first place, and we actually have regulations in place to allow us to operate and sell and consume cannabis. So I'm thankful for that. And just glad to be part of the industry, you know, like all the kind of things we don't really care for on the regulations. I lost my train of thought. I feel like I was going pretty good.
Well, but you're learning over those 2 years, probably learning a lot about what's working, what's not working.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, because like a lot of the times when you start something new, you know they'll be asking you, do you have any questions? It's like, well, I need to operate a little while for questions to be formed. And here we are two years later, and I think we have some pretty good comments and questions.
Pretty good list of questions up there. And to let folks know, you are owner of Permafrost Distributors, right?
That's correct, Permafrost.
And that's a retail shop in Sterling, and you have a growing operation as well, right?
We do, yes. We have a growing operations attached to the retail out in Sterling, and then a second growing location in Nikiski. So.
And one of your neighbors in the Nikiski cannabis growing community, Dolly Phelps with Peace Frog Botanicals.
Hey there.
And good to have you back. You've joined us before to talk about some of these issues. And again, just kind of looking back quickly over the past 2 years, how would you sort of paint the picture? How are things going?
Well, I think for the most part, like Chase said, you know, we are operating and many of us are operating successfully. Of course, we're generating quite a bit of money and tax revenue for the state. I think we're about between $1.2 and $1.4 million monthly. So that's a decent start. Some of the struggles that we're starting to experience, for me, I think that one of the biggest one is the tax structure of $800 per pound flat tax rate. And what we've seen is early on, the prices were very, very high for wholesale marijuana. And so, you know, if you're selling a $5,000 pound, the percentage of the $800 equates to isn't that bad. But now when prices are fallen, the market's become a little bit flooded in certain areas because there's so many new people coming on and existing. Now we're seeing that tax percentage increase because now we're talking about $2,500, $3,500 pounds. So that has actually been crushing to a few cultivators, and I am aware of a few that are struggling with the idea of even staying in business because of it. So the tax structure is a big one. And another huge, huge problem, probably the biggest problem, is our lack of access to banking. And there are other states functioning right now, you know, that have legalized marijuana that have state banks in place. Mark Begich is going to be meeting with our group tomorrow in Kenai to discuss some banking ideas that he has. But those two things are probably two of the two biggest issues that we've seen.
And Patricia Patterson also with us today. Of course, Patricia owns Highbush in Soldotna, or just outside of Soldotna. And the same kind of question to you. How would you sort of describe, characterize the past couple of years? Some growing pains, or have things gone relatively smoothly? What do you think?
Well, we've been very fortunate because we have done quite well out of the gate. One of the things we had to do is spend money very carefully so that we could survive during that first year when you're paying off debt and all. The absolute one thing I want to say is when this community had the opportunity to vote to keep cannabis legal versus have a prohibition down here, mm-hmm. we had a massive amount of support from voters. And from a retail end, that has just been delightful because we have so many local people who have chosen, even though sometimes they spend more money, they have chosen to join the legal market and stay away from the black market. And the success on a retail end has been really our local community. And that's, being in retail, it's been fun because I get to talk to people who are actually purchasing. And we've had great support from our community to keep us in business.
And I do want to talk about, because I know we have a couple of retail folks here. I want to talk about what that retail experience sort of is and what you try to bring to it for folks, and especially for folks maybe who aren't terribly in tune to the cannabis culture and that sort of thing. I want to get to that a little bit later. But something, Dolly, that you mentioned is now here we are again 2 years in, and we're beginning to see some trends. Everyone's kind of settled in a bit and beginning to see what works, what doesn't work. Taxes are becoming, as with any industry, as with any business, you're worried about what that tax bill is. We can get into that specifically, but I guess sort of more in broad terms, I'd be curious to hear what you all think about sort of the pace of growth of not just the industry as a whole, but as you've seen individual businesses, be they cultivators or retail stores. Is it a sustainable pace of growth? Is it filling what the market needs? Are there still opportunities? Did we get out of the gate a bit too fast? How would you guys kind of describe that? And whoever wants to start, Chase, do you want to start on that one?
Yeah, just with any other market, there's supply and demand. And whenever the supply meets the demand, it gets a little bit more tricky. And I think the people that will have a tendency to stick around are the people that are willing to just get through it and just persevere and just work harder. And it's personal choice at that point. Like a lot of people that started into this industry thinking it's going to be a quick buck are really finding out that it's absolutely the exact opposite of that.
And, you know, I don't want to muddy the waters too much here, but yeah, to make... For anyone who thought that maybe they could make a transition from the black market to an above-ground market, much as you said, just much trickier than probably anyone would have thought to go from an industry that's under the radar to an industry that's above board and has paperwork and all of these things.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'd like to comment on that, if I may.
Sure.
So we've had hundreds of applicants. There's hundreds more in the lineup. I do think it's a tricky industry to get into now. A lot of those relationships were made early on between the first to gain access to the market and open up shop. Now, one of the things that's extremely frustrating is the licensees have gone through enormous steps to make this process happen. They've, you know, done the application process. They've done their approval process, paid the application fees, had their inspections. They pay all their taxes. They do all the trip manifests, you know, where we're traveling, when we're traveling, what car are we driving in, what color is your hair. I mean, literally, the manifests are insane. And yet we still have a company called ACDC in Anchorage, which is absolutely chronic cannabis delivery. And these guys are an illegal cannabis delivery service. They've been operating for 3.5 years. They're still operating today. They pay no taxes. They are subject to no inspections, no application fees, no trip manifests, absolutely nothing. And it's really a huge slap in the face of all the licensees in the entire state. Because why are we subjecting ourselves to these very rigorous things that we have to follow? And nothing's being done about the guy. And literally, they drive around in a pickup truck with big 8x4x8 plywoods, ACDC chronic delivery, the phone number. We could call them up right now and you can order marijuana from this illegal delivery service. And it blows my mind that that's still going on.
Yeah, that's interesting that despite all the effort that's been put into trying to provide an avenue to be involved in this industry on a legal basis, that there are still folks exploiting loopholes, essentially. And how much, I'm curious, how much of that is not just the ability, the financial ability of the state to keep tabs on those things and actually enforce them, but how much of it is the culture changing in terms of enforcement, and how much folks want to go after somebody who's delivering pot? Has that changed? Do you feel like that's culture-wide that it's changed to put less of an emphasis on sort of the criminality aspect of it?
I don't know. I'm not sure I have a good answer for that one. I do know that this business was recently in court in August, but for me, the question still remains, why are they still operating? you know,
yeah.
How are they still operating?
Yeah. So clearly a lot of work left to do on these regulations. And Patricia, I'm sure that having been a retail store owner for many years, that probably is before the doors even opened, you saw things that were maybe not going to work out quite as well as had been envisioned on paper. Were there things that jumped out at you from the beginning, beyond just the simple, the finances and being cash only and some of those roadblocks? Were there other things that you saw sort of from the beginning as this is going to take some creativity to work around this sort of thing?
There really were some frustrations because my background is tobacco regulation, and tobacco has been highly regulated for many years.
You would think that there would be a lot of parallels to draw from an established regulated industry.
And you would think.
But clearly not.
Probably the biggest thing I see that's been something I didn't know I was going into is in tobacco, I am regularly audited by the state because, of course, I have to buy tobacco, pay the taxes on it, sell it in a legal manner. And they're always making sure that I'm not, it's called gray market in tobacco, but I'm not selling in my back door without paying taxes.
Right.
So we were kind of like the original drug of being taxed. And I own Lucky Raven Tobacco as well. And we're regularly audited by the state and have always successfully passed because we buy our tobacco legal and pay our taxes. In High Bush, what's interesting is I've never been audited. My enforcement is police enforcement attitude, not financial. And I find it a bit precarious because as a legal business, if I'm doing anything inappropriate, it shows up in the money. You have to prove where you got it. You have to prove you sold it. And this is your profit. These are your costs. It all adds. It's all on a tax form. You know, it's your finances. We have yet to get to a place with the Marijuana Control Board enforcement where they see us as a business. And instead of coming in and checking to make sure I have a sign that there's cameras and what badge you have on, is it current? And they're looking for us to make a mistake on an element like we're doing something like a crime. And I would love to see the Marijuana Control Board treat us a little bit more like alcohol and tobacco is, which is a legal business, that if we're doing something inappropriate, it's all found in audit. Same with the people who pay sales tax. I mean, we're all regularly audited by the borough. Make sure we're paying our sales tax. So that's been one of the biggest disappointments, is we are really treated a little differently.
Well, this is a great time then to sort of segue into what's coming up with the Marijuana Control Board meeting next week here in Kenai, and we'll have we'll give you all the details of that and times and places on our website, kdll.org. Also a great place to go if you would care to update your membership here during the KDLL Fall Membership Drive. What would be a mechanism for doing that, or how would you address the Marijuana Control Board about that issue? What would how does that change made? Is it an attitude?
I would say instead of hiring ex-policemen to be enforcers, I think they should be hiring CPAs. That's right there the difference.
And focus on the accounting as opposed to the behavior?
Absolutely, because when a business does something inappropriately, they're doing something purely to make more money. You know, I mean, anybody has had a friend that owned a business that...
it's all about the dollars.
It's all about the dollar, you know. And if we're doing everything we should be doing and following every regulation from state to federal and taxes, it all shows in our paperwork. It all shows in our bookkeeping. And I have been very surprised of not getting a financial audit yet. Although I'm visited to making sure that my badge is here and not there, you know.
Sure.
I mean, so
where's the real focus when it comes to enforcement? And yeah,
the focus,
what are the priorities?
The focus is a little odd. I would love to see them treat us more like tobacco and alcohol, which is to making sure we're running our business in a legal manner. And we don't, that's the biggest surprise and disappointment.
And for Dolly and Chase, I'm curious, you know, what, over the course of a couple of years, what has been, your relationship or your involvement with regulators, with folks stopping in to check? Has there been, much attention paid to your guys' businesses?
No, you know, I'm in pretty constant communication with AMCO enforcement. If I have a question, if I'm 99% sure about a regulation, I call and ask. So I'm pretty close contact with them just on the phone, or whether I'm inviting them to follow my Instagram account. I'm just trying to create this transparency between my business and the state so they can really dive in and kind of keep track of me in that form. They've never visited my Nikiski garden, and they've popped into my retail store twice.
And same for you, Dolly. Would you share that?
Well, beyond my initial inspection, I've had two inspections after. The first one was, I was called by the Department of Revenue Criminal Investigations Department at 11 p.m. And they said they wanted to come, they were in town and they wanted to come see me the next morning. So, which they did, but I did call the DOR and say, hey, is this customary for you guys to call up people at 11? They said, no. I said, well, I might be getting burgled. Because really,
who knows?
Anybody could be calling me, say, I'm coming over tomorrow.
Sure.
So that was concerning. But he came in, and then recently, because of the meeting here, you know, a few weeks ago, they did send enforcement down to the Kenai Peninsula to kind of catch as many people as possible. So we did another inspection, and I have not personally had any issues. You know, we've been able to pass, but I do know one thing I struggle with is the attention that AAMCO enforcement puts on really stupid things. Like, see that happy face right there?
Yeah. We've got a little happy face on a piece of paper
here. This has been
an
issue for another licensee. Getting a notice of a violation for having a happy face on a Facebook post about, hey, you know, we have this new strain in today.
I have a violation for an emoji of a happy face on that that somebody posted on my Facebook page.
What rule is being violated by social media posts?
No cartoons.
No, they call the entire social media world
advertising.
Which advertising actually means you're advertising a product for sale or service for sale. They say all social media is advertising. So someone had put an emoji on my Facebook page, and I have a violation for using cartoon characters to advertise marijuana.
That appeal to children.
Right.
To children.
And you can understand sort of the basic theory behind that, but its practical application maybe misses the mark.
I don't believe social media is actually advertising. I think they miss the mark on that.
Yeah. And then another thing is, you know, there's a cultivator that's received multiple violations. One of them was, if I remember correctly, that enforcement had found at least 10 plants that were 9 inches tall. Now, you're supposed to have a tag on them once they hit 8 inches tall. It's highly possible that during the evening, that plant grew a little bit, and so now, boom, we're going to snap you with a violation. To me, okay, it does say that in regulation, but shouldn't those efforts be spent on more justifiable violations that matter to the public safety?
Things that are a bit more cut and dried.
Absolutely.
So I think it sounds like it would be fair to say from your perspective that the state has a little bit of work to do in terms of the most effective way to interpret rules and enforce things, because things are on the book and it's black and white on the book, but in the real world, we all know that it's there's some room there, and especially when it comes to enforcement, there's a lot that is up to
them.
It's up to them. It's very subjective and a case by case basis. That's not necessarily baked into this system, but there are. And before we started recording, this is what I'm getting at. Before we started recording, you were talking about this notion of not treating marijuana grow operations in particular the same way you would treat a similar agricultural endeavor. It's not treated so much like a farm. It's not looked at as a farm. It's looked at as more of a manufacturing thing. And so you miss a lot of room for the variables that, just as you're talking about, what happens when a plant grows a little bit more than you would have expected it to, and you didn't catch that. And that's very interesting, the way at which the state is still viewing this sort of on paper versus the actual enforcement priorities.
Exactly. And that's where the problem lies in my eyes, is the enforcement priorities. And I believe the Marijuana Control Board should have the power to prioritize these things for enforcement and have enforcement take their lead. These are the things that we are looking to have enforced. These are our priorities. Focus on these things first. And I think that's the direction that needs to come from the board to give enforcement the guidance that they need so that they can do their job effectively without ruining or disrupting all these businesses that are we're doing our absolute best to stay compliant, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts there, and when enforcement is sometimes not when the rule isn't particularly intuitive as to why that ought to be enforced, and then it's really black and white, but it's not yes, very interesting, right? to see how all these things work. I want to get into, of course, what's coming up at the Marijuana Control Board meeting next week in Kenai. Before we do that, though, however, we're going to take a quick break during KDLL's Fall Membership Drive. We're joined this hour with Patricia Patterson from Highbush Buds and Dolly Phelps from Peace Frog Botanicals, Chase Griffith, owner of Permafrost Distributors. We're talking about cannabis and that new industry here on the Kenai Peninsula. This is the KDLL Fall Membership Drive, 283-8433. Again, 283-8433, or go online, kdll.org. We'll be right back. And we're back. Thanks so much for sticking with us here during day number one of the KDLL Fall Membership Drive, talking cannabis this hour with our guests Chase Griffith, Dolly Phelps, and Patricia Patterson. And wanted to get into, we've talked a little bit about some of the things that as business owners in the cannabis industry that have come up and you've noticed as trends over the past couple of years since marijuana became legal and businesses have come up. Now it's time to start, it seems like, refining some of those things and getting together with regulators at the state level, and that's of course going to be happening next week. And one more time to just kind of go down the line, I'm curious, sort of in broad terms, what your, insofar as you have a message to take to the Marijuana Control Board, what that is and what you hope, maybe just a couple of things that you hope will at least be discussed, if not solved. And Chase, we could start with you.
As far as messages to bring to the Marijuana Control Board, yeah, there's just a few things that need to be tweaked, and Dolly's certainly done her homework over here. But just like she mentioned, we talked about tax structure a little bit, then it can be incorporated and changed up a little bit. Banking for cannabis doesn't really have to do with AMCA per se. It's more policies in the banking industry and the federal level. And then allowing seeds coming in, MJ27, you know, these notes are courtesy to Dolly and looking at. And yeah, she may want to kind of touch base on a few more of those.
Yeah, the seeds part is very interesting to me, because the question was asked, you know, when the industry first was legalized, how does this all begin? Where does this illegal, illicit product come from to begin this business, and how is that changing, and what would you like to see changed?
Well, currently, so AS 1738-070 section B6.
This is Alaska state code.
This is Alaska state or statute.
Statute, yeah.
Statute, which is state law, does allow a marijuana cultivation facility who holds a current valid registration or license to receive seeds or immature plants from any individual 21 years of age or older. That's state law. One of the things AMCO has done from the beginning is tell people, no, you can't do that. Once you license, whatever you have that day is it. Until you can, because they don't want, they're concerned about a black market for seeds. The concern that we have is, A, they're not following state law. They've prevented us. There's financial impact that has already impacted cultivators because AMCO does not want to allow us to do this. Now, it's the choice for us. Do we want to challenge AMCO, follow state law, and then take it to court once they try to give us a violation? Or what do we do? So we've been pushing and pushing. They have a new form, MJ27, which they're going to be discussing next week at the Marijuana Control Board. It's basically a draft of how to allow the form that they want you to fill out when, say, you say, hey, I got this great strain at home. I would love to see it on the legal market. I want to give you a few seeds. So they are creating a form to do this. For me, we're already allowed to do it. They're a little late to the party, form or no form. We're permitted to do it under state law at any time once we've received a license.
And once again, let's look at it like farming. If you went to any farmer in the United States and said, oh, as of tomorrow, you cannot buy a seed, that farm has an end date. You can only clone or take cuttings from current stock for so long until it's compromised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I constantly say, well, look at the potato famine of the late 1800s. That was one of the reasons that it happened, is because they had a very fragile seed base with a thin layer, which then got a fungus, and hence we know about the great potato famine. There were no fresh new genetics coming to Ireland.
Right.
So what we have is a variety of cultivators in the state right now that have an end date because they cannot get fresh seeds.
So another, I'm thinking about this in sort of ecological terms, this idea that there needs to be some level of diversity into this seed stock for whether you're talking about corn or potatoes or cannabis. That diversity is always the key to keeping things healthy and moving forward. And it's interesting that this is becoming an issue when you look out and you see all the different, not just strains that there are, but then the different products that are derived from those strains. It's not a problem that I guess I would have ever thought about that there isn't much of a mechanism in state law to allow for increasing the diversity of what you're able to
grow.
There is, but it's being ignored.
Yeah, it's being ignored.
Okay.
It has been 100% ignored and as if it doesn't exist. There have been some missteps by Alaska Marijuana Control Board, and one of them is not understanding that a farmer needs seeds. I don't know a better way to say it.
Seems pretty simple. Well, I want to talk because Chase and Dolly both run grow operations. Talk to me a little bit about, I guess for folks who aren't familiar, what's the timeline for that process? How many hoops are there to jump through? How delicate of a process is it?
As far as taking cuttings and how long a mother can last and how many cuttings you can take off of that mom, I'm of the opinion that you can... As long as you keep that mother healthy and thriving and alive, I haven't noticed a decrease in potency in any of my genetics so far, and it's been almost 3 years since I've had all of them. So, one of our mom kind of gets too many legs, like the under branches start getting stripped off, and they get kind of older. I do something we call resetting it. We'll take a cutting of it and then grow it up, put it into a pot, and then get it sustainable on its own, and then that one will become the new replacement mom. So it's kind of rebirthing it.
And there is a thing, that is talked about amongst growers is genetic degradation over time and renewal. You lose the vigor. And I have not personally experienced this yet. I mean, I think we have with maybe one or two of our strains, like the cherry vanilla cookies, started out real, real strong over time, resetting, like Jay said, it lost it. And so now what do I got to do? I got to have more seeds. Well, thanks, AMCO. I can get more seeds, but I can't. And it's very frustrating, but that is pretty common as far as the vigor of a plant goes. Over time, eventually, that plant's going to lose its vigor. And you're not going to be able to get what you used to get out of it. Also, the idea that, it's going to create a black market for seeds, if they're really worried about the black market right now can get any strain they want from anywhere. They'll go online and order them or wherever they get them from. They're going to be able to offer the public something that we can no longer offer. To me, that's strengthening black market, and that will drive people away from the legal market if we can no longer offer what they want.
And I'm all talking about that. You mentioned earlier, Dolly, you're talking about prices and competition, of course, and just normal market forces. But and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've heard is that store prices, depending on what kind of a strain you get, how potent it is, you're getting stuff for roughly the same price as you would have gotten it on the black market years ago. And so that idea that it's cheaper at the black market is kind of out the window now, it seems like.
Yeah, it really is. The people that are saying that the black market's so much cheaper, just not really going to the retail stores and taking a look lately, especially with flour. Like, we have $35 eighths all day long, every day of the week. And as last I remember, years ago, the last time I bought an eighth off the street, it was $40. And so the prices are coming around, being more accommodating to the consumers, but then it comes back around to the tax structure, and it's more burdensome to the business people. So as it becomes more affordable to the consumers, it's becoming more expensive for the business owners.
And yeah. I'd like to comment on that too, is black market prices are generally a little bit lower now that the legal market has started, but they're still making a whole lot more money than we are, because they're not paying an $800 pound tax. They're not paying for surveillance. They're not paying application fees, taxes, license fees, any of that. So even though they're wholesale, black market wholesale prices are lower than ours, they're making way, way, way more money.
Profits are a bit different. The overhead's a lot lower when you're not.
Oh.
Right. Yeah. You didn't mention things like workman's comp, the liability insurance, right. Crop coverage, all these other
just
things.
Just basic owning a business.
Business
costs.
Ownership. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Well, it's so interesting to see that, what was I remember when the debate was happening a few years ago, and there were a lot of folks, and a lot of folks from what you might consider the sort of traditional business community, who had kind of a hard time taking this new industry kind of seriously. But the same issues for any business, any industry, healthcare costs and taxes, and doesn't matter. You're in business. You have a business license now. You share all these same concerns. That's kind of interesting to me.
And actually, our costs are always more because we're considered risk. So when you buy building insurance or business insurance or workman's comp, anything you buy to that you're required to have or to protect yourself as a business is quite a bit more expensive because there are so many companies that will not take us on. You know.
And in fact, so I also teach the marijuana handler course at akmjhandler.com. And what I've experienced is even though all I do is offer online educational service about Alaska state laws, I've been shut down by 3 different merchants because I'm marijuana related. And it's so frustrating because I'm not selling or buying marijuana. I mean, me personally, I'm growing marijuana, but the business, the educational business is not, and I'm still lumped in because it pertains to marijuana. So I'm still lumped in with being a marijuana business owner, and I've been shut down 3 times, so I'm unable to take online payments.
And this is sort of what it's like to be the first through the bulkhead.
We are definitely experiencing everything that is tough or hard. And so we are in the position of many of us at the beginning that got into this. We are starting to see people go away. It is the survival of the fittest. You have to work twice as hard to be just as successful as another business that is not marijuana, which is probably one reason I love the legal market so much, is because we're the best there is out there. I believe when I see all these other license holders, our passion and our dedication to make this work is so honorable. We just are such good folks because we have to be, and we have to work twice as hard. We have to spend more money. We have to understand our business. It's not easy.
When you think about it in that sort of classic business competition sense, it's interesting to me. It's the same. It's the kind of principle that I'm watching you talk about it with some passion and some real interest in wanting to do well as a business venture. By establishing those rules, you create a framework in which by following the rules and doing it better than the other person, you can find success. And that seems to be part of the drive for any business, for any entrepreneur.
But I think for this industry, it's harder.
Yeah, it's still the cultural perceptions. I know the answer to this question. You would say there probably is a ways to go with some of those perceptions, and not just here in Alaska. We've come certainly a long way in the way folks view cannabis, and Alaska always been relatively progressive in that way, but still a lot of work to do, especially on the federal level.
Oh, absolutely. Federally. That's what's inhibiting everything. That's what's putting us up against the 280E, tax code 280E, which does not allow us normal business expenses like delivery or your POS system.
The 280E is the federal income tax on a business that is in a Schedule I drug, which is marijuana. We're a Schedule I drug. So the expenses we have are based on our income tax alone is about double. For retail, it's about double. And for cultivation, I think it's about 50% higher. For example, when I buy insurance and I buy workman's comp and I do payroll, I cannot use that as an expense on my income tax.
You're taxed on it as if it were personal income.
Do you see, since we're kind of zoomed out here a little bit and talking about some federal things, something that got some laughs, so it was probably a year or so ago, I'm sure you all remember, former Congressman John Boehner made huge headlines when this very conservative congressman who supported very conservative policies about drugs all of a sudden became a lobbyist for the cannabis industry.
He's actually holding a seminar this month.
And so is that, do you see that as hopeful that there's some, by introducing some aspect of legality to it and then a legal market?
I got to say, this boggles my mind. There is one human being on this planet that is standing between the progression of marijuana reform in the United States, and that is Pete Sessions. He is the
Jeff
guy.
Jeff Sessions.
No.
Pete Sessions?
Pete Sessions. Jeff Sessions, the other guy. They're not related. Pete Sessions gets to decide. You know, there's...
Who is Pete Sessions?
I forgot what title he is, but he's the guy that gets to decide which marijuana bills are going to be heard. And he does this with every single one. And they go in the trash can. They don't even make it on the desk because he alone gets to decide which bills are discussed and which bills are they're going to take any action on.
So this is why I brought up the point about former Congressman John Boehner and his new gig as a lobbyist is, how far away are we from I guess what would be maybe kind of a tipping point, and I'd love to hear all of your views on this, a tipping point where the money where it becomes a fruitful enough industry that the quote-unquote traditional serious business community begins to take it. Is there a number? Is there a number of states that have to be legal? Where's the tipping point? Is there a tipping point?
I think it should have been hit already.
I think what we're seeing, and because we are seeing it in the FDA, I believe that the first tipping point will be rescheduling marijuana or THC and CBD, which are the cannabinoids in marijuana, into a Schedule II drug. If we schedule it from a Schedule I to a Schedule II, which can be done actually fairly easily, it keeps it illegal, but it makes pharmacies be able to get it.
And just a simple adjustment.
And I think that's going to be the first tipping point, is on a medical end. And then we don't have to worry about us three sitting here, because now it's going to be pharmaceutical companies.
And how does that change it?
I'll retire, because Pfizer is going to win.
And then you're just kind of battling Big Pharma directly. And you know, there's always going to be that craft niche, like top shelf, kind of like, you know, the Cassics of the cannabis world, you mm-hmm. know, the microbreweries.
It's the cottage industry will start to go away.
Yeah.
You know, then once again, it's going to be in big money.
And it'll be probably an ebb and flow, the same way you've seen where their breweries, for instance, used to be nothing but regional. Then they were all national. Now there's a focus on not even just regional, but hyper local again. You know, this, I guess before we get it, the next thing I wanted to get into, was to talk a little bit more about the trends that as business owners you've seen sort of emerge over the past couple of years. Before we get to that, though, I do want to take a quick break and pause to remind you that, of course, you are listening to the Fall Membership Drive here on KDLL. 283-8433 is the number if you would like to phone in, show your support for all the local programming we try to bring your way here on KDLL, or you can go to kdll.org. We're going to take just a quick little break. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us here during day number one of the Fall Membership Drive on KDLL, 283-8433, or you can go online to kdll.org. Speaking this hour about cannabis, the cannabis industry here on the Kenai Peninsula, some things that now that we're a couple of years deep into this sort of experiment, business owners and growers and retail operators seeing some things that work, some things that don't work, and of course, kind of using this hour as a jumping off point to talk a bit about the Marijuana Control Board meeting that's coming up in Kenai next week. Before the break, though, I talked about wanting to get into some of the trends that we've noticed from a regulatory standpoint, things that you've noticed that haven't worked. I'm curious, from purely a product and a sales and a consumer standpoint, what are some of the trends? And I guess just a couple of quick questions would be, you know, are people interested in, when we look at marijuana as a product and the flower in particular, what everyone might recognize as the little green buds, are folks just interested in a great big number of THC? Is that a big one? And
yes, terrible.
Yeah.
THC is only part of the component that you can judge a product from.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things that will make a product something you would enjoy, whether it be strength or how it affects you, how it smells.
The terpenes, the cannabinoid. There's so many different cannabinoids in a plant, and they all do different things. And it's unfortunate. I think most people know that it's not all about the highest THC, but we're kind of depending on our retailers mm-hmm. to educate their consumers. Because for me, for instance, I have this beautiful strain, gorgeous bud, super frosty, smells incredible. Almost had to throw it away because it was a 13.5%.
And that's just, and for folks who maybe aren't familiar, that's not a particularly high number.
No, the high numbers range 20s. You know, I think the highest that we've seen legitimately is 28. Now, one thing interesting is anything approaching the 30% THC is getting into the questionable range, because all plants have to have certain things in them, certain, you know, you've got chlorophyll, you've got lipids and fats, just to be able to sustain life. And so once you get beyond that 28-30%, you're getting into what the plant needs to exist.
It's starting to become a different plant at that
point.
Well,
it wouldn't be a plant. It wouldn't be able to grow or anything, because it needs these things to exist. So once you get into that range, it becomes very questionable if that's an accurate test result, because we know after a certain point, if that were true, the plant wouldn't even exist in the first place.
So THC is one of the big drivers. Again, from a retail standpoint, and Chase, for love to hear your input on this, and Patricia as well. What goes into sort of training the employees? I mean, there's state requirements that you have to go through, and you mentioned, Dolly, you help folks learn about those state requirements.
Yes, sir.
To get your license to be able to even work in a marijuana establishment. But what sort of training goes on sort of behind the scenes a little bit? What are you looking for in a bud tender? What do you want them to be able to tell folks? And
just education, you know, test results, full terpene readouts, just like
what are now? Tell me about this term, terpene readouts. I've heard you say it a couple of times, and I don't know what it is, and I'm not exactly a stranger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Dolly.
So terpenes are found in all plants. They give the plants their smells. So there's a terpene called limonene, for instance, which is also present in the peels of citrus plants. Caryophyllene is existent in black pepper. There's, you know, such a different profile, and that's what we call a terpene profile, is when we do have our product tested at a lab, if we request a terpene profile, the lab can provide a percentage of each one of these different terpenes or aromatic essences, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
that is contained in the plant, and they all give it different smells and flavors. What's another one is...
Like betamycerine?
Yep. And then there's myrcene, another one. Limonene. There's literally hundreds of these.
And this is something that's interesting to me and I'm curious about your opinion on this too. Maybe I feel like maybe one of the reasons that THC is such a driver in what people look for is because it's this one number that tells you a lot about it. And a marijuana plant is such a complex organism, and when you start breaking it down and measuring the things that are measurable about it, it can be pretty overwhelming to know all these things, and then compound that by, you know, X amount of different strains, and it becomes pretty confusing, I think. Yeah.
Right.
And so one of the ways around that, of course, is education. Do you find, in terms of trends, getting back to trends, what have you noticed about customers? Are customers, at first, did they come in knowing what they wanted? Did they come in not knowing a thing? Have they learned a lot over the past couple of years?
Well, we've been growing for the last 2 years. I mean, when we opened with, I believe, 10 strains on our shelf, which impressed me. I had never been in an opportunity in my life where I walked in to buy marijuana and I had 10 things to choose from. So I was quite impressed with myself, I have to tell you. We opened up and I got 10 strains. We currently today, at last count, we're at 55.
And
so
had 81
we
last
did
week.
Have 81. We've gone through
in just a couple of years.
Yeah, we're at 55 strains. So when you come into my store, you have 55 things to choose from. So, which just from that number alone, the biggest thing our customer sees is such a variety. The THC level is, I believe, something we have taught, because that's the one test that we are required to not only have on each thing we sell, which is what is the THC level, but it is the one thing we can tell the customer that's a fact. It's just not, oh, I think it smells very lemony.
Yeah, there's so much subjectivity too.
Right,
this
is a true fact. So I constantly take responsibility as a retailer that this idea that high THC is always better is something that we actually did in this legal market, and because it's the one number we have, and so teaching our public that it's not all in THC, that something with a higher THC can actually be a less effective enjoyment factor than something that's lower, because there are other elements that come into play, such as terpenes,
cannabinoids as well, like THCV. THCV is tetrahydrocannabinol. Now, this is not a psychoactive, THC, tetrahydrocannabinols, mm-hmm. is the main psychoactive component. But there's so many. There's CBGN, there's CBN, there's hundreds of different cannabinoids. CBD, cannabidiol is probably another one people have heard of. So all of these things comprise the plant and the effects and the potency. If you have a higher terpene profile and a lower THC percentage, for instance, you could have more of a euphoric effect than just a very, very, very high THC. And this is where, and it's really affected our prices. Like, as a cultivator, it's driven us to the ground as far as prices go. I mean, if I have a beautiful plant and it's low THC, I can almost not sell the thing. And it's really unfortunate that our markets become that way, because it's not genuine, it's not real, and it's very harmful to what's happening.
From a retail standpoint, that is constant education. It's just, don't just look at the THC. The THC is only about a third of the element of why you should buy this plant, mm-hmm. you know, or buy this bud. And so what we found when a bud tender is educating the public, they really don't want to hear all these big numbers and big words and VAs and terpenes and curcuses. What they want to know, they really don't. What they want to know is, I'm looking for something that I can... I'm an artist, and I want to make music tonight. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend that would be the best product you have,
right,
that would allow me to be more creative? And I need to stay awake, or I need to, you know, I want to relax tonight. I want to sit on the couch and let the world go away. So we almost on our end have to take all this information we know. And believe it or not, the best thing a bud tender can do is be a person that goes home and tries it.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, the best thing I can get as a bud tender is someone who will try the product for me. And then they can say, okay, this affected me where I just wanted to sit on the couch and watch a movie. And they're like, that's what I'm looking for.
Exactly.
So it's interpreting all these numbers we get into effects. And that's really the best thing a retailer could do. And
all the while being careful not to say anything about medical.
Right. Oh. We are not allowed to use medical terms. And
energy, I'm sorry, is not a medical
term. I actually got a violation for using the word energy. Once again, we talk about some of the things that I don't think they do that anymore. I think it was a test. I think I was but we are constantly saying we cannot use medical terms. And it's really difficult because, if I go and give my mom a call and ask her, hey, mom, I'm having some trouble sleeping. And she says, hey, well, you know, I always found that if I took a real hot bath and read a book, I go to sleep much better. Is that medical advice, or are those two people talking? And we struggle with those gray areas of regulation, which is, if I say it out loud, am I giving medical advice, or am I just finding that when I smoke this strain that I sleep better? Is that medical advice? So we do struggle with some of the regulations on that definition of medical advice.
And while we're on that specific regulation, that's another thing that's an issue. This state has had medical marijuana long before recreational.
Mm-hmm.
There are literally thousands and thousands of medical and scientific journal documents that talk about the medical effects of cannabis. Why do we have this stupid regulation that says, and I get it, you know, your bud tender is not your doctor, but your bud tender can tell you about the product that you're considering for whatever your personal medical purpose.
Well, and you know, the inability of, because of where marijuana sits at a federal level, the inability to study it in controlled environments and all of this. I mean, we could do a whole nother show just on that particular policy issue alone.
Which has changed recently.
Which is changing, and there's much more awareness about it, which is helpful. The other thing I wanted to ask about, and Chase, for you, again, someone who owns a retail store, I'm so interested in what the trends are for consumers as this industry grows. Patricia, you mentioned earlier that when you started off, 10 strains of flower, very bare bones. Now you go into a store and it's just filled with all sorts of different stuff. Chase, maybe you could talk a little bit about how the range of products has changed and evolved and grown over the past couple of years.
Right. So first we saw the cultivators coming online, getting established. And so now these variety of flowers have been coming out. And so Patricia can have as many strains as she has on her shelf. And now we're starting to see concentrates starting to catch up with that a little bit with the vape pens, the decarboxylated oil, shatter, crumble, wax, batter. Like, the list is long. And I'm noticing the trend of the sales of flowers starting to has come down and the sales of concentrates are coming up, and they're almost one-to-one. And I kind of envision, just like it has in other states, the concentrates will surpass the flower just because the convenience, discreetness, just everything about it is just a lot easier to
It's
consume.
Sort of the next step in consumption. When we talk about concentrates, maybe for folks who aren't familiar, if you could give us sort of a real quick breakdown of what that means, a marijuana concentrate.
Mm-hmm. So I'll take some trim or sugar leaf up to we work with Midnight Sun Manufacturing, and they will process it with, and extract it with CO2, and then they take the oils and they put them in the little vaporizer pins, and it's just the oil in a preloaded pin. You just buy it and get it home. Take it out of the package, put it on a battery, inhale, and done. And the convenience and the ease of use is really, really appealing.
Yeah, very appealing. And when I talk about the range of products, you know, edibles are becoming a bigger part of the picture. Mm-hmm. I know the CBD products that come in a variety of applications and mechanisms are more popular. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, again, that overall range and how that's growing, and maybe what's the next big thing. Patricia, or
well, you know, we—I think Chase is right in the manufactured products, mm-hmm. because Alaska didn't have a lot of manufacturing to begin with. You know, it's not like we have an empty RC Cola warehouse that went out of business in 1998 sitting up there in Anchorage, and someone can lease the property or buy the property and now make infused sodas. We were very behind in manufacturing. The only thing we really manufactured up here was fish. We didn't really manufacture many products at all.
Right.
So we're very behind in manufactured products. This is where we're starting to see more variety, which is fabulous. You go to Washington or Oregon or Colorado, and the amount of manufactured products with THC or CBD in it is mind-blowing. It's almost like it's almost as big as Walgreens and aisles of things.
It very much is. I mean, gum and mints and soda,
coffee,
and
there's
coffee.
Like
and
Keurig coffee cups.
You know, we don't have – you can't even compare it. Now, once again, Oregon, Washington, Colorado allows for – investors from all over the country. And here, one thing that's different in Alaska is we can't
local
have
investment
local
only.
Investment only, mm-hmm. no outside investors. So we're all cottage industries.
Is that a good thing?
Who knows? We'll find out.
I think it is.
Right. Yeah. And I appreciate it in the sense that it's kind of, we're not competing with the Walmart of weed. We're
yeah. As I was going to say, as sort of a hedge against that, you know, the what ends up becoming the Budweisers and the this's and the that's.
Yeah. And then all of our Alaska money goes to the fat cat sitting in Colorado.
I was going to say, in retail in Portland, I believe, is 80% owned by people out of state.
Yeah.
So we don't have that. So when you're dealing with mom and pops and cottage industries, which all of us are, even the biggest license holders are really maybe, you know, 6 to 10 investors. They're still relatively small operations in comparison to the lower 48. So from a manufacturer standpoint, it's being patient. We're starting every couple of months to see new products coming on. And it's really taken some time. I think the thing that people ask the most for are drinks. We just don't process drinks up here very much.
Yeah.
So I think that will be the next, you know, you might see somebody have something that you could actually consume your THC and CBD products through a drink. That would probably be the next thing I see. I'd love for somebody soon to be have that.
And we're running just a couple of minutes left. I guess that's maybe a good place to kind of try to wind it down a little bit for Dolly and Chase as well. What is the next big thing? Be it a policy change or a product availability?
There's too many things. As far as products go, I would absolutely love to see, which I've made it myself at home because I like to brew beer too. And I did a marijuana infused beer. I did a blackberry stout. It was 6.5 ABV. And I used a little over an ounce of bud in my wort process with my hops. And it was phenomenal. And it didn't get you over intoxicated. And I know it's the next big thing, but of course everybody's afraid, oh no, marijuana and alcohol, what are we going to do?
Well, I don't know if people have been mixing those two things for very long at all.
Yeah, it's new.
It's new. And Chase, how about you? What's the next big thing?
I just think we'll just continue to see the concentrates becoming trend upwards in sales, just because, like I mentioned before, the ease of use, like the tourists coming in the summertime, you know, before they were dependent on the pre-rolls and the joints, now they can pick up these vape pens and be a little bit more discreet, since there's no public consumption, there's no place to go and consume these products as of right now. So yeah, the concentrates are just going to continue on the uptick.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I wish we had more time, but we're just about out of time for this hour. Once again, I want to thank you all so much for coming in, joining us, sharing with us a little bit about the cannabis industry and what you all as business owners are working toward and hoping to see happen again as we head towards this big marijuana control board meeting in Kenai next week. That's a pretty big deal. So again, thanks so much all of you for being in.
Well, thank you
for having us.
Thank you.